Okay, this half hour, Linda's going to continue with this story, this incredible story about this insecticide, the killing of the honeybees, and we'll be right back with her on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you with Linda Moulton. How, Linda, you ought to be given an award of some sort for the work you've been doing on this one.
Well, I really care about the planet, and it seems to me we're cutting off our nose to spite our face by destroying so much Earth life that we need as a balance for us to continue to evolve. And in this case, food, our very food, depends upon the honeybees and the pollinators in order to be pollinated and to grow. And if we, in the, what should we call it, the race for the most money in corporations making poisons, put that as the priority over having a healthy environment, then we are going to self-destruct. And right now, commercial honeybee colonies and wild pollinators are in serious decline all over this planet. Entomologist Christian Krupke, PhD at Purdue University, knows that the neurotoxins, such as the nicotine-based insecticide clothianidin, can kill honeybees after the smallest exposures.
Jeez.
He also knows that the number of acres in the United States now being planted in 2012 with clothianidin-coated seeds is the largest on record, approaching 200 million acres. And in a January 3rd, 2012 research article for the Science Journal PLOS ONE, he explained that, quote, virtually all of the corn seed planted in North America is coated with neonicotinoid insecticides, such as clothianidin and thiamethoxam, close quote. Every seed, George. Professor Krupke wondered what a study of the agricultural landscape in Indiana would reveal about what ways and how often honeybees are exposed to these nicotine-based toxins. Well, he did 2011 investigations and summarized the research in this recent Science Journal this way, quote, during spring, extremely high levels of clothianidin and thiamethoxam were found in the planter exhaust material produced during the planting of the treated maize seed. We also found neonicotinoids in the soil of each field we sampled, including unplanted fields. This stuff is being blown over soil everywhere. The corn pollen from treated seed and pollen collected by bees and stored in the hive all had clothianidin, close quote. And he even found that the dandelions and other plants growing near planted fields contained nicotine pesticides at dangerous levels for honeybees and took photographs of the honeybees foraging around the dandelions along the clothianidin-filled soil. Recently, I talked with Professor Krupke about the implications of so many different ways that honeybees can be exposed now to clothianidin and other neonicotinoids. Here now is Professor Christian Krupke from Purdue University in Indiana.
So we put the bees through this analysis, and the neonicotinoids came up as the insecticide really stuck out. And the only real way for bees to have exposure to these was from being near treated corn seed.
And I was shocked to read in your study that was published that every single seed of corn planted is covered with clothianidin.
That's right. Yeah. Virtually every corn seed is treated with clothianidin or thiamethoxam, one of the two. Clothianidin goes by the trade name Poncho. Thiamethoxam goes by the trade name Cruiser. Those are the major seed treatment insecticides. Thiamethoxam, when it's ingested by a bee, becomes clothianidin. So they're very similar compounds. Their mode of action is the same. They're both nerve toxins.
And doesn't that mean that the honeybees and pollinators really don't have a chance as long as the neonicotinoids continue to be used as seed coverings and spray?
Certainly as far as pesticides go, neonicotinoids are covering a large, large portion of the landscape. 150 to 200 million acres this year of annual crops will have neonicotinoids on them, 94 million in corn alone. So One of the reasons these products are so widely used is they provide systemic and persistent protection early in the season against some pests. But when you get later in the season, when you have pollen produced by these plants, that pollen has these compounds in it as well. These are different because the plants are charged up at planting time. The seed is coated with this material, which then is taken up by the growing tissues of the plant. So these plants are kind of on, to some degree, all year.
Could you explain how sensitive honeybees and pollinators are to the neonicotinoids?
Honeybees are extremely susceptible. So 2 or 3 billionths of a gram, if it's fed to the bees in sugar solution, 2 to 3 billionths of a gram of these compounds is a lethal dose. So they're super, super toxic. And we're putting it on an unprecedented amount of acres. Now, what we found is that during corn planting, there is exhaust material that arises from behind the planter in the form of used talc, there's soil, and it blows around beyond the field, and it lands on plants adjacent to the field. It lands on bees if they happen to be there in the air, if bees fly through it. And this is all ways that bees can become exposed. There's a group in Italy that did some work where they flew bees behind corn planters. They had a hive at one side and a feeding station at the other side of the field, and then they just planted the field. The bees fly through that cloud behind a planter, and they get covered with dust that has neonicotinoids on it at many times lethal concentration.
Now, doesn't all this research indicate that we're never going to have healthy honeybees and pollinators if we don't get rid of the neonicotinoids?
Well, if we want to continue treating these incredibly large acreages with this blanket application of pesticide, is it worth the cost? You cannot reasonably expect to put an insecticide over hundreds of millions of acres and have pollinators of various types, including honeybees, exposed to it and not have negative effects.
And other countries in Europe, such as France and Italy, there are huge efforts in Europe to ban the neonicotinoids. And now in the United States, pesticide organizations and organic farm organizations are trying to convince the Environmental Protection Agency that this makes no sense to have an insecticide that so easily kills and sickens honeybees when we need the pollinators to grow our own food.
That's correct. Yeah, that there is a linkage between a decline in the health of various pollinators and these pesticides.
Professor Krupke, it seems that the combination between the work that you have done at Purdue University and published in January of 2012, and then the University of Padua study in Italy about the clothianidin dust coming from the planters themselves being lethal to honeybees and pollinators, that if you had those two studies alone, that should be enough to give pause to the Environmental Protection Agency in its so-called registration and partial registration of clothianidin, no matter what Bayer and other producers of nicotine-based pesticides say.
Yeah, and there has never been any doubt that it does kill honeybees. We can debate whether it should have been registered in the first place, but it is now, and it's not only registered, it's over hundreds of millions of acres. But the one thing we know is that we are exposing these honeybees and other pollinators and many other types of insects over an unprecedented acreage. We've never done pest management like this before.
If we were able to stop the nicotine-based insecticides from being applied in the United States tomorrow, how long would it take for the soil and the plants to reach a point where there was no longer any nicotine-based insecticide killing honeybees?
These compounds are very persistent, and there's a report from soils that they analyzed from Saskatchewan, Canada, where they persist 18 or 19 years, the half-life. So they're very long-lived, and in our own work here in Indiana, we found it in the soils 3 growing seasons after application. So they're long-lived. They're quite persistent, these compounds are.
So isn't it fair as a reporter to say that what Dave Hackenberg told me in February of 2007, as a longtime beekeeper, the nicotine-based pesticides are killing honeybees and pollinators, and we better slow down its use?
I would say Dave Hackenberg looks more right today than he ever has. Yeah, I would definitely say that.
And that the conditional registration process in EPA, so many people say it should be stopped.
Well, I would agree. It's been used as a loophole. It's a form of gerrymandering almost, you know. It's rigging the system so that you can do things you shouldn't be allowed to do. I can see how it would have started, and when you have emergencies and you need something now, but it's not used that way in practice. Now it's used as an end run, and then once something is everywhere, there's a perception we can't live without it. It's a lot harder to get it off the market than it is to stop it from getting on.
EPA's using conditional registration over and over to allow things like imidacloprid and clothianidin to get to market before they have even been judged safe or unsafe. Again, Niwot, Colorado, honeybeekeeper Tom Theobald.
Correct. It's my understanding that 70% of the active ingredients that have come on the market in the last 15 years have come onto the market with conditional registrations. Now, in many cases, that may be a practical way to deal with it if it's a minor concern, something that can be ironed out over time. But in the case of clothianidin, it was a serious question, and this EPA scientist believed that it should not have been released to the market until that research had been completed.
If clothianidin is lethal to honeybees and EPA continues to get away with conditional registrations and ignores the legal petition, ignores honeybeekeepers, ignores the science, what does it say about the relationship of the Environmental Protection Agency to the people who live in this country?
If the EPA is allowed to just pick and choose which regulations and laws it will honor and which it won't, we have no law. And that's the situation that we're in. With respect to clothianidin, clothianidin has failed to meet the requirements of registration. The very criteria that the EPA established itself, expecting that it was going to get away with it, and it didn't. Clothianidin has failed to meet the requirements of registration, period. The EPA chooses not to recognize that. The interesting thing is, clothianidin was rushed to the market not because it was a unique remedy for some sudden insect scourge, but because Bayer's patent on imidacloprid, the first neonicotinoid, was about to run out.
And they wanted more money.
Money, of course. So we've been subjected to 9 years of this carnage to protect Bayer's market share.
And to underscore, George, how clear it is to scientists who are studying the nicotine-based pesticides and specifically clothianidin, I want to just share with you and the audience three of the short but penetrating sentences from Professor Krupke's research that was reported in PLOS One. Quote, clothianidin was found on all the dead and dying bees we sampled. While apparently healthy bees we sampled from other locations did not contain any detectable levels of clothianidin, that reinforces the idea that it is the nicotine-based clothianidin and the neonicotinoids that are making sick and killing the bees, because there were healthy bees that did not have clothianidin on them. Clothianidin was the common denominator to the sick and dying bees. Another quote, our samples of dead and dying honeybees consistently demonstrated the presence of clothianidin, and that suggests the levels of both clothianidin and thiamethoxam found in our sampling of stored pollen in May of 2011 may have contributed to the deaths of the bees that we analyzed, and I think they would say today definitely is the cause. Now, the third, quote, the finding that bee-collected pollen contain neonicotinoids is of particular concern because of the risks to newly emerging nurse bees, which must feed upon pollen reserves in the hive immediately following their emergence. So the bees from the beginning to the end are caught into the cycle of a poison that is a neurotoxin that kills these bees with the tiniest, minuscule parts.
They're killing us, Linda, aren't they?
Yeah, and that there was no effort. There was no honest, credible effort on the part of Bayer Corporation to ever demonstrate in an EPA regulatory demand that they proved before any market registration that this was safe to pollinators and to the honeybees. It never happened. An EPA for nearly a decade kept granting what are called conditional registrations without any of this done correctly. And Bayer then was able to put this out on the market in the United States to its now millions and millions and millions of acres, killing all these bees. And that EPA's own internal scientists knew this, knew how dangerous and deadly clothianidin is to honeybees and pollinators when that November 10th, 2010 EPA document was leaked. And it was leaked to Tom Theobald in Colorado, who upon reading it realized this is explosive because it means knowledge inside of the Environmental Protection Agency about what obviously has to be considered as the major reason for colony collapse disorder. And meanwhile, what has it been? Every 2 months, we've had headlines in the newspapers that it might be microwave, it might be the Israeli virus, mm-hmm. It's Nosema, all of these other reasons, because Bayer and Monsanto and the creators of these poisonous toxins do not want the media and the public to be on their backs about the fact that they're producing poisons that are killing the pollinators that every country needs. It's unreal.
Good job, Linda.
Thank you.
And don't let it go.
No, I will not.
Don't let it go.
And I'm glad that we on Coast and I at Earth Files and some of us are actually trying to report some of the facts here, because it's very clear that we're living in a world now where the health of the planet is not nearly as important as a profit bottom line.
So true. By the way, Dr. Robin Falkov has sent me a story about some pollution radiation from Fukushima in St. Louis, where I just left, 90 times the registered amount. So I'm going to get you that article and turn you loose on that one, too.
Yeah, Fukushima is a big problem still.
It is huge. Last hour, of course, we'll do conversations with Linda, but something very strange is happening on the island of Malta. There's a structure there. How old is this structure, Linda?
6,000 years.
6,000 years. And they're still trying to figure out what it is, aren't they, and what it's for.
What has happened is because of a woman that I'm interviewing who was there as long ago as 1990 and experienced the sound of a voice in what is called the Oracle Room, in what is the oldest freestanding, completely sculpted like you would sculpt a city building in the air above ground, but this is sculpted just like a big, beautiful building below ground. And when a male voice is in this oracle room, in this absolutely breathtakingly beautiful underground, we'll call it building, in Malta, the voice has a penetration and a resonance and a frequency that they are now researching. And in the next half hour, we're going to hear that it may actually have been constructed to affect human mind.
Looking forward to that. And if you need to email Linda, it's earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And we'll be back with much more with her on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, of course, conversations with Linda, stories, questions for her. We've gotten some great stories that way as well. But let's come back. Let's find out what this strange structure is that she's been talking about in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Linda, I've been waiting for this one. This is a strange one. What do we have?
Well, I find this very fascinating. Let's, in our mind's eye, go to the center of the Mediterranean Sea. and think of where Palermo is at the end of Italy. And on the other side of the Mediterranean is Tunisia in North Africa. And we're going to this very ancient island complex known as Malta that's about, maybe 100-some miles. I think it's 176 miles east of Tunisia. And the entire island complex mass is only 122 square miles, making it one of the world's smallest states now. It's known as the Republic of Malta. But about 6,000 years ago, people there built extraordinary megaliths and temples, including the world's oldest known freestanding structure, completely underground, known as the House of Pliny Hypogeum. The underground temple is carved out of the rock as if in the negative of a surface structure that would be constructed in air. Imagine that in your mind. If you build something in the air above ground, how would you do columns and spaces in solid rock underneath? And that begins to make you go to the absolute astonishment of looking at the perfection of this 6,000-year-old hypogeum, of which I have beautiful photographs at earthfiles.com. And recent research suggests that the massive, elegantly constructed hypogeum was made specifically to vibrate with certain frequencies. Popular Archaeology, in its March 5th issue, reported this. The structure is unique in that it is subterranean, created through the removal of an estimated 2,000 tons of stone. Low voices within its walls create eerie, reverberating echoes, and a sound made of words spoken in certain places can be clearly heard throughout all of its three levels. Now scientists are suggesting that certain sound vibration frequencies created when sound is emitted within its walls are actually altering human brain functions of those within earshot. Now, there has been some other recent research at Newgrange in England and in Peru that also indicates that stone structures there emit certain frequencies that they suspect affect human listeners, perhaps affect the minds with sounds as the Malta hypogeum seems to now in the present, and most likely did in the past. And keep in mind, we're talking about constructions on Malta of 6,000 years ago. And also remember that Göbekli Tepe, even though these are pillars discovered now underground and are being excavated, they are as mysterious as Malta, and they are 12,000 years ago. So between 12,000 and 6,000, something highly intelligent was at work on this earth, which humans might have had some kind of a precedent that either they followed or that these were built by something that might have other influence beyond just evolving Homo sapien. Now, recently, I talked with Linda Einix, founder of the Old Temple Study Foundation and the Mediterranean Institute of Ancient Civilizations based in Sarasota, Florida. Linda first visited the Malta Hypogeum in 1990 and was haunted by its beauty and the unusual sound quality. I asked her what surprised her the most in her first visit that provoked her to found the Old Temple Study Foundation 4 years later in 1994 and still going strong today in 2012 with brand new research in Hertz frequencies generated in the hypogeum. Here now is Linda Einix from Sarasota, Florida.
Without question, it has to be the hypogeum because the sound quality there is exactly what it was 6,000 years ago. And that's as close as we're ever going to come to hear the ancient world. When I found myself in the first of these megalithic temples, my jaw dropped and I was grabbing the sides of my face. How is it possible that we don't know anything about this?
Right.
Because I had been exposed to such things around the world that I knew that it was authentic. Here I am on the original pavements with walls surrounding me and these carved stones with relief carvings and about 20 different kinds of spirals. Just absolutely, I don't know what to call it. There's just, I have no words. And it grabbed me then, and it hasn't let go since. And as a result, I didn't choose it. It chose me, but my life became wrapped around it. I was impressed with the antiquity, the fact that they are the oldest freestanding buildings in the world, and they remain that. The oldest, according to the textbooks, is the Gigantea Temple on the Maltese island of Gozo, which dates to about 3,700 BC.
So almost 6,000 years ago.
Almost.
Is that the particular temple that you and your colleagues have discovered a link between how they were built and the structure and sound?
Not in particular that one. And it gets a bit complicated. I'll try to explain. This monumental building in large stone, as it occurred in Malta, was a phenomenon that went on for more than 1,000 years. There are more than 23 sites on the islands where there are remains of these temple structures standing above ground, and they are in various states of repair. But what really triggered this research is an underground site of the same time period, the House of Phleni Hypogeum, which is architecture in the negative, cut from the solid bedrock. An estimated 2,000 tons of stone were removed to create these chambers that were closed in antiquity. At the end of the temple period, the hypogeum was, for whatever reason, sealed and remained that way until 1902.
Can you give us your firsthand experience in the hypogeum?
There was nobody there, no guards, no nothing, and we went in on our own and just explored. And even for me, just knowing the age of the space and that there were people living and breathing in these same spaces 5,000-6,000 years ago was enough to get my radar working. Someone demonstrated for me a male voice in what's known as the Oracle Chamber. And I was told the legend and the theory that a male voice will carry through the whole hypogeum and a female voice doesn't do it.
The Oracle's position, is it a carved out, very specific place in the hypogeum?
Yes. There is a niche carved at the back of this chamber that, once you recognize it, is a very, looks to me, deliberate amplification channel for throwing the sound. It seems to me that they took advantage when they were cutting these chambers. They took advantage of natural faults in the limestone and also of the way they could get the sound to move where they wanted it.
And how did they know that?
Good question. My own theory is that it was part of a school of knowledge that was handed down, perhaps as a very distant myth by the time they got it. But there are some very interesting parallels in Malta. You can see them side by side in caves and ceiling configurations in the caves, which then sort of evolved into underground tombs, which then became the hypogeum, which then became architecture created from scratch in the above-ground temples.
If there was some older knowledge that was then applied to Malta, is it possible that we now are shifting back 12,000 years ago to whoever, however, the Göbekli Tepe site in Turkey was built, in which the German archaeologist doing very careful carbon dating says that the pillars were first erected 12,000 years ago. That means that there had to be sophisticated intelligence operating before 12,000 years ago.
Absolutely. You don't do something like that just by getting a bright idea. You have to organize people. You have to think through every step of the engineering, the quarrying, the transporting, the how are we going to fit these and what configuration do we want them in. These are huge stones. You don't decide once you get there where you're going to put it. There's a study done by a team in the UK that point out that a lot of the sarsen stones at Stonehenge are carved to be concave to reflect sound. We're talking about so far back in time, there is no history. There's nothing written, and it's all speculation. It has to be based on science. Science is all we have to reconstruct it. As deep as the waters are for trying to make a connection between Malta and Anatolia, where Göbekli Tepe is located, or between the islands of Sardinia, Menorca, and Portugal, and the British Isles, where megalithic constructions are found that are so similar, you're really taking a giant leap there. But the evidence sort of adds up to at least some kind of knowledge that was handed off. I think about Bronze Age people who hit the islands of Malta and discovered these temples still intact. They would have been impressed, I can tell you. But what was the sound? It's been found by the study of physics, actually, that many of these chambers resonate at a certain frequency and create what's known as a standing wave, which is a particular way that the sound bounces back and covers itself. The range for Newgrange, Wayland Smithy, these enclosed passage tombs, is between 90 and 120 hertz within the range of a male voice. The hypogeum, it's been found by some techno-savvy musicians, vibrates at this same frequency range, but principally at the 110 hertz area, 110, 111. That number seems to trigger brain activity in a particular way. A sound generated, even a tone with a headset, has been shown in the laboratory to change the brain activity, shifting from the language center over to the other side of the brain and firing up the creative center and the part of the brain that deals with mood and with emotional processing. And this 110 hertz is equal to an A2 in music. It's a bass baritone. It's a very easy note for a baritone to achieve. Imagine singing or toning that note in a resonant chamber, getting all this sound bouncing off the stone walls, apparently was impacting on their brains, whether they knew it or not.
Have you experienced this where you've been there and there's been a effort to generate these tones and measure them and see how you felt?
That is part of the research that's ongoing right now in Malta. And the experience with voice is much different from an electrical tone, because with voice you get harmonics. Sound that varies enough that when the echo comes back, it's very rich and very complex. I feel it in my bones. The sound in the hypogeum is like standing inside a giant bell. The way the sound bounces off the sides, and especially a low voice.
It seems to me that one of the more profound implications of all of the work that you're doing is the baton passing from a previous intelligence, pushing back the intelligence on this planet so much further than the line drawn in the Sumerian sand at 5,000 years. Göbekli pushes it back to 12,000, and who knows how much further, and what was the intelligence that inspired the Greeks?
I think since we've come out of the trees, we've had some idea that there was something bigger than we are. But I think that we are so far removed from back then, it's going to be very hard for us to suspend everything that we've learned since and get into the mindset of people who were part of nature, not dominating nature. Limestone has particular acoustic properties, and the Greeks knew this. They chose limestone to line the seats in their amphitheaters because of its ability to transfer the sound. Where did they get that information? Maybe they found out for themselves. Maybe they got it from somebody that came before them.
That we would have limestone structures and marble structures long ago, when the emphasis, perhaps, of intelligence on this planet was sound, reverberating sound, echoing sound, sounds for some relationship to the unseen and the divine.
Speaking to God, the voice of the earth. It just feels like stone is the bones of the earth.
Is it vibrating in your bones?
I suppose because our bodies are so much water that they are going to feel the sound wave on some level. And that's part of what we aim to find out with this research, which involves not only an EEG on site, but also blood pressures, skin temperature, the whole biofeedback range of things that we can do on site in the hypogeum with exposure to human voice right in that range of 110, 111 hertz.
And George, in your mind's eye right now, imagine that if we go back to all of that marble and limestone, whether it is in Egypt or Greece or Göbekli Tepe or Malta.
Or wherever.
that if we go back 6 to 12,000 years ago, that this might have been a planet of extraordinary sounds, that vibrations and echoes played such a vital part of life then, as opposed to iPhones now.
How did they know this stuff, though?
Well, I think that there's other intelligence involved.
I think so, too.
And there is the most interesting research paper that was presented 2 months ago at the annual American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting that was held in Vancouver. And there is a scientist named Stephen Waller. He is what is known as an archaeoacoustics expert. This is somebody who is looking to how sound might have been used long ago in these periods of time that we're talking about. And he has had a special interest in Stonehenge and the construction of Stonehenge. And he did a paper in which he was presenting this hypothesis, and I'm reading a quote. "My theory is that the ancient Britons, and we're going back 4,500 to 5,000 years ago on Stonehenge.
Mm-hmm.
My theory is that the ancient Britons, when they were hearing two pipers in a field, that would be people with flutes, were experiencing sound wave patterns where in certain locations, as you walked around the pair of the pipers with their flutes, you would hear loud or quiet zones. And then if you could look at this from an overhead view, it would look like the spokes of a wheel. And as you walk around the circle, every time you come to one of these sound wave cancellation points, it feels like there is this massive invisible object in front of you." And then he described how he went and did this experiment, and this was part of his paper, and that he took people into a field where there were two people playing flutes. And then afterwards, he asked the people to draw diagrams of whatever it was they experienced behind their closed eyes listening to this music. And the people were not told anything about interference patterns or Stonehenge or any of his hypotheses. And then he said it was so interesting that when we took the blindfolds off of them, and after having described the presence of the people, the listeners described that they thought there were large structures. And then when they discovered that they had been taken to a field, it was open. There was no structure there, only people playing flutes. The people in the experiment were flabbergasted. So something between the human mind, certain Hertz fields, and relationship. Now, I'm going back to the history of Malta and saying that there was use of stone being sculpted specifically to generate sounds to influence human minds. This scientist is saying that he thinks Stonehenge was made specifically to generate certain patterns of sounds when flute music was played. And we know that it's far more complex because Gerald Hawkins, the astronomer, did a whole book called Stonehenge Decoded about how it could be used to keep track of the moon and the sun and stars, and it was like a computer. But I think it's so interesting that scientists today in 2012 are beginning to go back in time and realize that sound, vibrations, and frequencies were playing major roles in all of those standing pillars of stone in circles, the hypogeum in Malta underground, so exquisite and elegant and absolutely as perfect as anything that was ever built on Greece. It's just underground. And then it makes you wonder about who were the inspirers of ancient Greece, and what role did sound play?
More to come with Linda Moulton Howe in just a moment. Conversations with Linda when we come back.